And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 30th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is novelist and memoirist Jillian Lauren. In the second half, Nicole Nelson will talk with Jonathan Galassi, author of the novel Muse. First up is Jillian Lauren. She's the author of the memoir Everything You Ever Wanted, published by Plume, the New York Times bestselling memoir Some Girls, My Life in a Harem, and the novel Pretty. Jillian has an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University. Her writing has appeared in the Paris Review, the New York Times, Vanity Fair, the Los Angeles Magazine, Elle, and Salon. She's a regular storyteller on The Moth, and she blogs about motherhood and writing at the award-winning JillianLauren.com. She lives in L.A. with her husband and son. And again, she's here to talk about Everything You Ever Wanted, a memoir. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh.
I have to give you a little snapshot of what's going on in my house right now, just in case things
okay.
get chaotic. We're fostering a 6-month-old baby right now that just showed up 2 days ago.
Oh, my goodness.
He's sleeping, but he may wake up.
Well, I think you talked about this at the end of your book, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. We'll hear more about that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Anything
well,
you want to know.
Well, you know, let's begin by hearing you talk about Everything You Ever Wanted and how the book came about.
The book came about, I started a blog when we were in the process of adopting our son, Taraku, which you know is essentially the heart of the book. I mean, it's about a lot of things, but it's really about my relationship with my son. And when we were getting ready to go to Africa, he's adopted from Ethiopia, I just wanted, everyone was super interested in the story, and it was really interesting and really exciting, but I just could not, I didn't have time, I didn't have the energy to communicate with everyone about it. So I was like, I'm just going to dump the story online and put some pictures up online, and that way I can just be like, you know what, read the blog. And I never expected it to be for anything more than just our friends and family. And then we brought Taraku home, and as I continued to write in those very challenging days of early motherhood, it became like a lifeline to me. And then I started to notice that people were leaving comments who I didn't know. And it just kind of caught fire. Like, through the adoption community, people started to read the blog, and I started to really, started to be a very meaningful thing for me. So, I think that the book is very different from the blog. It's a different voice in the blog, but it was really that process of writing about motherhood and about our struggles that inspired writing the book.
Interesting. Well, I have to say that in case there are listeners out there who may think the book isn't for them because they have no interest in adoption, the book is about so much more, and for memoirists, it's quite instructive on the art of memoir. It's conversational, it's poetic. It brings us into your experiences as a writer, as a mother, as a wife, and a daughter. And so I enjoyed it on various levels. I also thought it was really interesting how in the book you talk about going to a therapist with your parents to talk about the memoir you're writing.
Right.
Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I do appreciate you saying that, and I think that a lot of people hear like, oh, either it's a book about motherhood or it's a book about adoption, and already they've gone like flatline. They're like, and then you sound like the Snoopy teacher, the teacher from Peanuts after that. You're like, like they think that if they're not parents or if they're not in the adoption community in some way, that it's not going to be interesting. But really, I think that there are so many incredible themes that come up. There's, you know, themes of belonging and trauma and all of this stuff that's very relevant, you know, to people personally and in our culture right now. So, and race and all kinds of stuff. So I do appreciate you noting that there is a more universal reach to the book. And then what was, oh, the second question was going, sorry, I'm like in full, it's been so long since I had baby brain, or like, you know, the no sleeping baby brain. So I went to therapy with my parents to tell them, I actually told them what was in my first memoir before it was coming out, and I thought that that would be the right way to do it. And I was really trying to do a very loving and conscious thing, but also to do it in a way that felt safe to me and moderated by, you know, an objective party. And it went very poorly. And, you know, in retrospect, there are things that I would have done differently about it. But there is, yeah, so the book, you know, this memoir, Everything You Ever Wanted, does talk about my first memoir, Some Girls, coming out, that what that process is like for me, because it all happened at once. I feel like for 10 years, all I was praying for was a book and a baby, a book and a baby, I just want a book and a baby. And then it was like, be careful what you ask for. It all happened at the same time.
Well, you just mentioned, a few minutes ago, you mentioned theme, all the different themes that are a part of the book. And were you thinking theme when you wrote it, or is that something you discovered after you wrote the draft, that there were all these themes going on?
Well, I never write to a theme. I write...
I'm so glad you said that.
I write the true story. Like, my goal is to write the truest, most authentic story that I can. And when I do a first draft, I don't think about anything. I don't even think about punctuation. I don't even, like, I just sort of, like, soft focus my eyes and just type. Because I like to really, I like to see where the story leads me, rather than me trying to shoehorn my writing into this idea of what I thought the story should be before I started. Now, of course, I have ideas about what I think the story should be, but I'm almost always wrong, is what I've found. So I try to be as free as I can with the first draft. And then, of course, it's really like only much later that I start to be able to, like, pull thematic threads through, you know, and look at it from a craft perspective and from my editor brain and not just my, you know, poetic writer brain, and to say, oh, you know, I want to make sure that this, that I'm using this and addressing this, and that this can be a certain lens through which I tell this story.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Jillian Lauren. Her new memoir is Everything You Ever Wanted, and she will be at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series on October 13th down here in Orange County. You can find out more about that at penonfire.com. In a minute, I'd love to hear you read from Everything You Ever Wanted, but I wanted to say also, it's a fast read and it has suspense. It has a dramatic arc, which I think is difficult to consider for, especially for first-time memoirists. Has storytelling always come easy, because it feels just like it's just flowing and it's just coming out?
No, it was so hard for me to learn how to tell a proper story. And it was not the thing that was my initial like talent. I think that, you know, I certainly always felt like called to write, but I think that what came easily for me was always voice. You know, like voice and an attention to detail and like an unusual perspective on the world, because I think that that's just very organic to me. But I was a terrible storyteller. I had no idea. I was like, everything I wrote, I was like, it's just experimental, because like I didn't know how to structure it. So I had to learn, you know, I started out by studying the hero's journey. And really trying to use that as a template and, like, you know, use that to create the spine of a story. And I was working on that with fiction before I ever tried applying it to nonfiction. I think that you're right that it's for first-time memoirists, it can be a really hard concept to understand that it's not a story just because it happened.
Right.
It's just events.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a laundry list of events because it happened. Like, you have to look at it. You have to be able to look at your life and create meaning out of it. And,
so,
you know, the way I do that, and, like, I'm a pretty, I'm a sucker for, like, traditional, you know, narrative arc, maybe because I studied it so hard and really fell in love with it. You know, that's how I create meaning out of things, is by, you know, giving them a beginning, middle, and an end, and, you know, looking at what the stakes are, looking at, you know, looking at stories from a perspective of desire and fear.
So did the story, then did the novel, you know, it sounded like you barreled through the first draft. Did all that come out in the first draft, or was that something that happened through revision or a little of both?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really helped me with story structure has been live storytelling. So I do, you know, I tell live stories mostly with an organization called The Moth, which is really wonderful, and everyone should check it out. And they really taught me about, like, having to actually tell a story in 10 minutes is very hard. Like, the shorter something is, you think it's easier. No, it's actually harder. Especially since you can see I have no problems talking, but to actually be concise and exacting about my stories really helped. So I think that now I've internalized it to the point where it does start to come out in rough drafts. Like, it is less of a challenge for me now to start to see where the story is in something, but it's not something that I consciously do in a rough draft. Because it's something that I consciously apply later.
Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear you read from Everything You Ever Wanted, would you?
Sure, I would love to. I'll read a little bit from the prologue. And what is happening here is it is the morning of my son's adoption hearing, like final adoption hearing, which is all the final paperwork and stuff gets signed, and then he's yours for good forever. And I decided to get up and go for a walk. And I got lost on that walk. And then I got stuck. So this is what happened. I feel strong as I push toward the top of the hill. When I reach the crest, the trail looks clearly marked. I figure 15 minutes to the bottom, perfect. When I arrive home, Scott will have just woken up with tea. The morning chores will be underway. That's my son, T. Taraku, we call him T. The morning chores will be underway, and I will plunge in. But now I'm headed down, and something is wrong. I hike enough to be able to feel when a trail is going wrong, probably heading to a dead end. I go back to the last fork and take another trail, which also ends abruptly. Through the branches, I can see the back of what looks like a high school down below. I figure I can bushwhack my way through the brush, then walk through the campus and back out to the street. It won't be far. After that, my home is just over the next familiar hill. It's harder than I thought. Burrs invade my shoes. An errant twig scratches my face. Another tears my favorite leggings. At the bottom, I remember that this isn't the era I grew up in, of smoking pot and getting felt up in the woods behind the library. This is the era of high security schools. A tall chain-link fence blocks my passage. My chest seizes and I recoil. When I was a kid, the jagged end of chain link ripped my hand open. I still remember the pale blue T-shirt I was wearing, the smell of damp earth after I hit the ground. It always takes me a minute to remember this injury never happened to me. It happened to my father. When I was little, I used to ask my dad over and over again to tell me how he got the thin white scar that bisected his palm and ran down his forearm nearly to the elbow. I heard the story so many times, it became almost as much a part of my own body as it was his. In my dreams, it's always me, stumbling, lightheaded, nearly bleeding to death, trying to hold my torn skin together with my blood-soaked T-shirt. I'm not delusional. If I think about it, I realize that, of course, that scar is my father's scar. Still, the memory comes to me with a momentary stab of fear. I'm chilly in the shady grove, my sweaty shirt cooling in the morning breeze. It's one of my greatest fears that my hurt will become Taraku's, in spite of my best efforts to give him a whole new world. Maybe the legacy of our parents' pain is unavoidable. Maybe these scars are not just psychological, but somehow cellular. Maybe the darkest moments of my story are so deeply inscribed in my body, my voice, my very soul, that I won't be able to help transmitting them. I steel myself, wedge my toe into the diamond of chain link, and pull myself over the top. Maybe so, I think. But I can also transmit this. Even shaking with fear, you can still scale the fence.
Thank you so much. That was Jillian Lauren reading from Everything You Ever Wanted. As you were reading, I was also thinking about what you said earlier about voice and how voice has always come easy to you, and that learning, you know, the learning narrative arc was a little more difficult. And it also seems that a part of voice is that ability to, especially as a memoirist, is that ability to reveal yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And has that always been easy as well? I mean, you know, you're in this book, a reader feels as if she knows you, right? She knows, you know, your strengths, your weaknesses, all the foibles. Are you conscious of that? Are you worried about that as you're writing? Or is that just something that is just so intertwined with voice?
Okay, hang on. I'm just going to pick up a baby while we're talking. Hi, buddy. Hi. I've got a little bottle here for him just for this occasion. Hi. Good morning. It's okay. Good morning. It's just your friend Jillian right here. Voice.
Yes.
I'm really sorry about
that's
this.
That's all right.
Please tell me exactly what
just
you want to know about
voice.
How much
is voice intertwined with the ability to reveal yourself without,
oh, right,
without fear?
Right. No, that did not always come easy to me at all. It was really, I mean, I think it was a learning process over the course of my three books. In that, I did it and was really scared when my first memoir came out. You know, I just spent weeks, I feel like, with my head down on the dining room table having a panic attack before that book came out. And the experience with my family was really challenging, although that seems to be resolving itself now too, so that's all been, you know, had a positive outcome. But it was such a wonderful experience telling that truth and publishing that book. You know, it was transformative for me, and so it's not like it was less scary the second time because this book was about my family and about, you know, it's a sort of like my book baby about my baby baby. It was really, you know, very tender stuff to put out there. But, like, I felt like I had been through that. I'd been through that machine a little bit already, and it had been just a really terrific thing for me to be, and such a point of connection. And it, so I feel like that my voice was even truer and braver in the second memoir, because I had already had that experience. And I've had it again. It's just been, it's been really a touching, amazing experience publishing this book that I wouldn't trade for anything.
Well, sadly, we're at the end of our time, but gladly, you're going to be at the speaker series in a couple of weeks.
Good timing, Baby J.
We can continue. thank you so much, Jillian. I'll see you on the 13th.
All right. Well, I'm really sorry about the interruption, and I look forward to speaking.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Jillian Loren. Her book is Everything You Ever Wanted, published by Plume. Stay tuned. We will be back in a few minutes. Nicole Nelson will be talking with Jonathan Galassi, author of the novel Muse. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. The show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, Barbara spoke with memoirist Jillian Loren, about author of Everything You Ever Wanted. Next up, I'll be speaking with debut novelist Jonathan Galassi. Jonathan has worn many hats in the literary world. He's a translator of poetry, and he is a poet himself, having published 3 full-length collections of poetry. His honors as a poet include a 1989 Guggenheim Fellowship. He has published poems in literary journals and magazines, including Threepenny Review, The New Yorker, The Nation, and the Poetry Foundation website. He was poetry editor for the Paris Review for 10 years and was an honorary chairman of the Academy of American Poets. He is currently the president and publisher of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. In 2008, he received the Maxwell E. Perkins Award, which recognizes an editor, publisher, or agent who, quote-unquote, has discovered, nurtured, and championed writers of fiction in the U.S. He has also published his first novel, Muse, published by Knopf, and I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Jonathan.
Hello, Nicole. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh.
I'm thrilled to be there.
Well, to start us off, could you introduce Muse to us and tell us what the book is about?
Muse is the story of, it's set in the past and it goes into the future, actually, but it's about how publishing used to be, and it's about two old publishers who are lions of their profession and who hate each other, but who both love a certain Ida Perkins, who's the great poet of her time. And it's about how these relationships play out in a kind of counterfactual fantasy about a world where poets are the most popular, the most significant, the most sexy cultural actors in the world. This is a poet's revenge, in a way.
Can you also elaborate more on how the book came to be? I'm so curious about this because, I mean, in the bio, we went over all of the roles you've played in publishing, and so why a novel at this point?
Because I'm getting to be a certain age, and I thought, you know, you've worked with all these novelists, you've always said you couldn't do this, but I decided that I would give it a try as a challenge and to have fun, and it was great fun writing this book. It's a kind of satire about the world that I've known, but it's also a kind of love letter to the absolute devotion to literature and to writers that that many of the publishers that I've known over my life have shown. So it's a kind of elegy to a way of life that's disappeared, basically. The small publisher going around and talking to the small bookstore owner about these wonderful new books. It doesn't work that way today, as you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's talk about the character of Ida Perkins in the book. Can you talk about developing her?
Well, Ida is, some of my characters are, how would you say, based in, to some degree on people I knew and loved and admired and even didn't like some of them. But Ida is totally invented. She is the spirit of literature in a way. And I developed her as a kind of, I wanted to create a new poet who, and insert her into literary history. So she's a kind of, she's a rock star poet who is more or less the same vintage as, say, Elizabeth Bishop, but she's very different from her. She's freewheeling. She has a lot of different marriages. She's unconventional. She's shy. She has some of her poems become famous rock star songs. She ends up living in Venice with another older poet whom she's very close to. She's a kind of echo of many things that happened in modern literary history, but with her own special glamour and allure. I totally made her up, and I had so much fun doing that.
Hmm. So, I mean, like you just said, she's totally invented, and the book is called Muse, which is a female term. But I was interested in that you had total control over her character, that you made her female, given, you know, this discussion going on currently about the attention paid to male writers. So how conscious was that decision about her gender? And did you go back and forth on that at all?
Well, no. I think I thought it was that these men, these two old geezers, these publishing lions, they were obsessed with her and in love with her. And they idolized her as a writer, but they also wanted to love her as a woman. So she had to be a woman because that was the focus of their erotic interest. And also the spirit of poetry would have to be a woman somehow. That's just the way it is. It's always been that way from the Greeks on down. And she's a kind of avatar of the poetic spirit, and it has to be a woman, definitely.
Jonathan, would you read to us from your book?
Shall I read you the beginning? There's the prologue that sort of tells what the book is like, and I'll read some of that.
Sure, and it's relatively G-rated, right?
Oh, yes. There's nothing here that anyone could really take exception to, I don't think. This is a love story. It's about the good old days when men were men and women were women and books were books, with glued or even sewn bindings, cloth or paper covers, with beautiful or not so beautiful jackets and a musty, dusty, wonderful smell. When books furnished many a room and their contents, the magic words, their poetry and prose, were liquor, perfume, sex, and glory to their devotees. These loyal readers were never many, but they were always engaged, always audible and visible, alive to the romance of reading. Perhaps they still exist underground somewhere, hidden fanatics of the cult of the printed word. For these happy few, literature was life, and the slowly burning pages on which it took shape were the medium of their cult. Books were revered, cherished, hoarded, collected, given, and sometimes borrowed, though seldom returned. The rarity of an item, the number of copies in an edition, the beauty and complexity of its printing, occasionally the quality of its contents, determined its value. Once in a great while, a book was deemed to be worth millions. Writers, in those days, only a few assumed the mantle of authorship, a demanding and even dangerous vocation, were the high priests of this religion, shunned and held in suspicion by the unwashed, but idolized by the initiated faithful. This is also the story of our country's love affair with one of its great poets. Ida Perkins streaked across the sky of American life and letters as a very young woman and remained there in one way or another until her death in 2010 at the age of 85. While she lived, her every word and movement was noted and commented on, lionized, bemoaned. Our critics, most of them anyway, fell down before her, but so did the commonest of common readers. She made poetry fans out of ordinary women and men, and when she died, the outpouring of national grief was such that President Obama designated her death day, which was also her birthday, a national holiday. We make so much of love. We live for it. We ache for it. We convince ourselves that we'll die without it and make the search for it the focus of our lives. Yet love, my friends, is a terrible pain. It distracts us. It sucks up time and energy, makes us listless and miserable when we're without it, and turns us into bovine creatures when we find it. Being in love is arguably the least productive of human states. It is not, as so many believe, synonymous with happiness. So when I say this is a love story, I'm telling you it's not entirely a happy story. It is what it is, the raw truth, the fabric of our heroes and heroines' messy lives, the scent of their days and nights, the marrow of their souls. Proceed with caution.
Thank you. That was Jonathan Galassi reading from his new novel, Muse. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. Now, Jonathan, you mentioned earlier in writing a novel, you did so because it was something challenging and fun. But I'm curious about the craft and learning the craft. So was it purely osmosis being around all these great writers, or did you take any classes, or were there any books that were helpful to you as you figured out the mechanics of novel writing?
What I did was I decided one summer I was going to try this. So every day I wrote for the morning, and I never looked at what I'd written, and I just kept writing more every day, and I put it away for a year and got it out a year later and looked at it and decided I had something there that I could work with. I need to kill off my editorial instinct to work on the book. I didn't take classes. I have taught fiction workshops. I work with writers. I absorbed a lot by doing that, but you know, being an editor and being a writer are totally different things. So I had to kind of give myself permission to try. Otherwise, I would have been too critical of what I'd written, and I would have kept re-editing it every day, which would not have been a good way to write the book. I never would have finished it.
And I was curious also, I mean, jumping to the novel form, did you attempt any short stories, or did that interest you at all to try?
I've never written short stories, and I think short stories and novels are actually very different, and in some ways it's harder to write short stories because you have to focus a few pages on some sort of transition or change or strong plot point. I was trying to write something that was a kind of portrait of a world that I'd known that also had this satirical element and this idea of creating a character whom I could insert into literary history. So I had those goals. And a plot kind of came along with them slowly. Eventually, it emerged. But it was a lot of seat of the pants, and I had that, luckily after a while I got a wonderful editor to work with me, Robin Desser at Knopf, and she was very tough on me, and that was very important to the process, because I was a newbie, totally a newcomer, even though I've worked with fiction writers for my whole career.
Well, yes, you talked about working with writers and editing, and I understand that you edited Franzen.
Yes, I've worked with Jonathan on all his books.
Wow, and it's funny because I was reading Purity sort of in tandem with your book.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, your styles are very different, but there was some flavor that remained that sort of overlapped. And I wonder if he inspires you at all. What I'm referring to is just a love of language and the way that you use vocabulary and the way you name your characters with affection and flair. And so I'm just curious to hear a little bit about that.
Well, if that's true, that makes me happy. Yes, I admire him greatly. And I think he's one of the great writers at work today. I don't put myself in the same category with him, but I certainly have watched how he writes, and he has such incredible fluidity and decision, and he always has ever since he was in his 20s. His work has evolved, but it's loosened up in certain ways. It's become more realistic. But I think he has a great sense of humor. So I think that my book is humorous too. So maybe there's some overlap there. But we write about very, very different things. So, but I admire him hugely, of course.
Yeah. I'm talking to Jonathan Galassi. His new novel is Muse. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And going back to the book, there's Ida and her poetry, and you don't shy away from this challenge that you've constructed for yourself of having basically the greatest poet, the Proust of poetry. And so you include several of Ida's poems in the novel, and you said in an interview, I believe it was on Salon, quote-unquote, "I had such a ball writing them because they're much easier to write than your own poems because they're not mine." Can you talk about that challenge and how you embraced it like that?
Well, it was part of the fun of the project was if you posit this character who's supposedly the great poet of her generation, and then you have the temerity to write her poems, you're already setting up a counterfactual situation. So I knew that I would not be writing the great poems of her generation, but I wanted to write something that had some degree, some angle of plausibility, so that the reader would enjoy the game of this. And I got into it. I came to believe in Ida, and I came to believe in her emotional situation. And the book, as it goes on, darkens some. I think it deepens it. It's less purely satirical, and it talks about her situation and her emotional, her own muse, which is the subject of her poems. And I found in doing that I could connect to a voice that was Ida's, and it was easier to do than writing my own poems, because when you're writing your own poetry, you go down into the well, which is often empty, but Ida's well is never empty, because it's fictional. And so I could construct her feelings, I could construct her situation, and that was part of the game of the book. But it also had some other depth that surprised me as I was doing it.
And
does that make sense?
It does. And also, in talking about those surprises and the darkening of the ending, I'm curious, as a pantser, how you found your ending. Can you talk some more about that process of leading this project to its ending?
Well, there are several endings to the book. There's the end. There's the surprise when what happens is that there's a young editor who works for these, who's close to both these old men, and is obsessed with Ida, and he contrives to go visit her in Venice, and she ends up giving him her last manuscript. It's sort of a play on the famous story, The Aspern Papers by Henry James, where this man is trying to get hold of the letters of this famous poet. This is sort of the opposite of that. He actually gets the manuscript, and the manuscript has many consequences for all the people in the book. And the poems are clues to all this. So that's another part of the game of the book, is the poems actually tell you what happened. And but and how that plays out in the lives of these people and who dies and all is part of the fun of the book. But then there's a kind of aftershock. What happens to this young editor, Paul, after Ida dies, after all these changes happen, and what does it all mean? And then the book is really talking then about what happens to literature after the author dies, after all the changes that are happening in our publishing business, et cetera. Where does the author's work fit into a changing literary environment? That's a big part of the aftershock of the book. So the book sort of ends in several ways. That is something that I didn't sit down and plan it. It evolved slowly. Some writers sit down and outline a book and then they write it. Others let it happen as it goes along. It develops, and many great writers do it in those two different ways. So I found that part of the game, the discovery of doing it, was this aftershocks. There are certain other aftershocks that Robin got me to take out of the book. But I didn't sit down and plan it from the beginning, no.
And one more question about this letting it happen, because before Paul goes to Venice, he makes a stop in Frankfurt, and there's this fun chapter or two that take place at the book fair there. And, I mean, as a reader, it's fascinating, you know, as someone who loves that stuff. But did you know from the outset that you would explore that in the novel, or did Paul just end up there?
Well, that was that in a way that piece could almost be lifted out of the novel. It's a kind of satirical portrait of the Frankfurt Book Fair that I was writing about how publishing used to be, and that was certainly a big part of it. In fact, I'm leaving for the book fair in a week, so it's still going on, though in a very different way than it used to. But that was really part of the first phase of the book, which is a kind of how would you say, elegiac portrayal of how publishing used to work. And so I did know that I was going to do that. I wrote that early. Yes.
I'm talking to Jonathan Galassi. His new novel is Muse. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. So, Jonathan, we are drawing down on our time, but I do want to ask you, I'm very curious, what kind of writing advice you have for the writers listening, especially those working on those debut novels?
Well, I think one of the things that I really learned in doing this is, first of all, you need to give yourself permission as a writer, and you can interpret that in a lot of different ways. If you want to write a book, you have to give yourself the permission to do it. In other words, you have to open up to what's really eating at you, what you really want to talk about. And I do think that the way I went about writing it, which was to write without editing, without criticizing yourself, to get yourself really deep into the thing before you start trying to evaluate it and shape it, was good for me, and I think it could be good for a lot of people. So I think you need to know what you want to write about and then really go for it and be honest and searching, and don't shut off your options early on. I think plotting out a book if you're a debut writer is probably not a great idea, because you're going to discover the book as you write it. As an editor, I've often noticed that people learn to write books by writing them, i.e., by the time they get to the end of the book, they know what they're doing, and then they often have to go back and rewrite the first part of the book to sort of take away the crutches and the false starts and the false directions and make the first part of the book in sync with where it has actually taken them. But I think that if you really are a writer and you have something to say, it will eventually come out, and then you're going to have to deal with the whole ball of wax you've created. But those are some of my thoughts about how to really be free to write. You have to free yourself to do it. That was certainly true for me.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show.
I loved it. Thank you so much for asking me.
That
was. I hope those writers are out there really digging in.
Yes, and letting go of their fear and running with
it. And we're here to read the books.
Right. And have a safe trip to Frankfurt, right?
Thank you, Nicole.
That was Jonathan Galassi. His new novel, Muse, is published by Knopf. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara's back with novelist Michelle Hunnevin, Off Course, and biographer Tracy Dougherty, The Last Love Song. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, on behalf of Barbara and myself, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.